talk is cheap. What do you do? What's your action? Who are you really? Based on a lot of words, anybody can talk. What can you do? What can you do?
May of 1975, we busted into the headquarters of the Department of Corrections in Olympia and planted a 6-inch diameter pipe bomb under the director's desk and issued a communique. We did not know what we wanted to call ourselves, but we recalled a quote from a prison activist in California named George Jackson, who was assassinated by prison guards. He said, "Hurl me into the next existence. I don't care what you do. I'll come back. I'll dog you from the grave." And we thought it was probably about time that somebody made good on George's promise. And so we called ourselves the George Jackson Brigade.
As Portland sees an increase in local police violence, it is important to consider the broader context of modern state repression. The Ad Hoc Committee to Connect the Dots is taking on this challenge by organizing a one-day mini-conference that seeks to nurture a greater understanding of the connections between policing, prisons, and political prisoners. Tonight on Circle A Radio, we'll hear from one of the organizers of the conference, Lydia Barthlow, and we'll also hear from Ed Mead, Bo Brown, and Mark Cook, members of the George Jackson Brigade, who will be speaking at the conference. Stay tuned.
My name is Lydia Barthlow, and I'm one of two members of the Ad Hoc Committee to Connect the Dots. So the Ad Hoc Committee to Connect the Dots was a couple of us that started having discussions a couple of months ago, and there was a lot of community discussions around policing in Portland after, as most of you know, lots of police violence. And a few of us were talking about how some other pieces of the puzzle were being left out of that discussion. So in my mind, policing is just one piece of a larger puzzle of what is today's modern state repression. If we're going to be talking about policing, let's talk about how they connect with other ways in which our communities are harmed. So political prisoners and the prison industrial complex. The prison industrial complex is a term that was sort of created after the term military industrial complex. And the idea of the prison industrial complex is that prisons are no longer there to restore justice to communities, but they now are actually a way of waging war and waging genocide on specific communities within the United States. And sort of as icing on the cake, they are making lots and lots of money. We are hosting a small conference called Raise the Walls, and the idea of the conference is that Portland will stop and start thinking about political prisoners and prisons. I became interested in policing and prisons and political prisoners several years ago when a friend of mine went to prison and was sentenced to do 22 years. And prisons really weren't part of my sort of mental landscape. And when I lost a friend and part of my community to prison, I sort of became obsessed with the ways in which prisons really don't make our communities safer. Prisons actually often rob us of important people and then return people to the streets not any healthier, not any more capable of being part of a community than they were when they went in. Prisons are absolutely one of the most racist institutions in the United States. I think if the KKK could ever get as many black men behind bars as the United States government has done, the KKK would be a pretty scary institution, but we rarely think about the United States government in that way. Prisons are absolutely one of the most patriarchal institutions. If you think about women's bodies being under control 24 hours, 7 days a week, and you think about how that functions in a penitentiary system, I think you'll start looking at gender in prisons a little bit differently. Prisons are also one way in which I think class war is absolutely happening. And so, again, I've been thinking about prisons pretty intensely for a couple of years now. So when people start having conversations about policing, my first thought is, oh, police are the first door that takes people into the prison industrial complex. So I see policing as sort of step one for ground zero, and I consider prisons to be ground zero. I also think that in the Pacific Northwest right now, there are some discussions about political prisoners, but we often tend to focus on political prisoners that are coming out of sort of the Green Scare movement. And I think that that's an interestingly white movement. While I support that movement wholeheartedly and have had many friends and still have many friends in prison because of Green Scare stuff, I think that it's important for us to be looking outside of the Pacific Northwest and sort of outside of the whiteness of the Pacific Northwest and to be thinking about political prisoners on more of a broad scale. I think in many other parts of the country, prisons and political prisoners are seen as sort of a central part of the movement and things that we're struggling against. And in the Pacific Northwest, specifically because we are such a white place in many ways, those are seen as sort of side issues or things that are kind of always at the back of our mental landscape, but aren't seen as like an emergency. So I think when a lot of the policing, when a lot of police violence happened in Portland, we have political prisoners and the prison industrial complex that sort of put on the back burner because we have more emergent things. And I'd like to see a little bit of a shift in that.
This is Lydia Barthlow speaking about the Raise the Walls conference, which will take place at Portland State University on October 3rd, featuring many ex-members of the George Jackson Brigade.
So I have worked with various ex-members of the George Jackson Brigade in the past, and in my mind that they are a group of people who have a very sort of intimate and visceral knowledge of the prison industrial complex, and they also have a really interesting view of what it is to be a political prisoner and an ex-political prisoner. Most of these folks have spent time in prison, and many of them were politicized while in prison in the 60s and 70s. So essentially, the George Jackson Brigade was a mixed-race, multigendered revolutionary group that did a variety of activities in the 70s for human liberation. And I am most inspired by them because, as I said, many of them have done time in prison and they have intimate knowledge of things that I'm interested in. Also, it's an exciting year for them because finally they have two books out about them this year. One of the most important being Guerrilla USA, written by Daniel Burton Rose. And it's sort of it's just an overview of their work in the 70s and some of the challenges they faced and the good and bad things that came out of it. So the presenters at the conference, the presenters that are ex-George Jackson Brigade members, will be Rita Bow Brown, Ed Mead, and Mark Cook. Rita Bow Brown identifies as a working-class butch dyke. She did many years in prison for political activities. She was politicized while in prison, and she is known as the gentleman bank robber. So she disguised herself as a man while doing expropriations for the movement and was on the run for a couple of years while the police looked for a man. So that's my favorite story about Bow, but I'm sure that she will tell you more. Ed Mead will be the second presenter. He is a prison activist out of Seattle, also ex-George Jackson Brigade. Ed identifies as a Marxist-Leninist who has kind of a interesting take on where politics should go in the future. And the final George Jackson Brigade presenter is Mark Cook, who is an ex-Black Panther member, also an ex-prisoner, and who has a lot of really interesting things to say about race and the movement today. So those are the speakers for Sunday afternoon.
That was Lydia Barthlow, speaking here on Circle A Radio. Now we'll hear from one of the ex-members of the George Jackson Brigade, radical queer revolutionary Rita Bow Brown. This piece aired on the August 26th episode of One World Report. One World Report is a weekly community-centered hour-long news and public affairs show produced by KBCS volunteers. The One World Report seeks to shed light on matters of social, economic, and environmental justice, to further understanding of racism, sexism, homophobia, and other forms of oppression, and to investigate the conditions for creating a peaceful and just society. This is reporter Amber Cortez.
Rita Bow Brown had a self-described rough upbringing.
It was a pretty typical working-class family of that time period. A lot of alcoholism, a lot of abuse, a lot of extreme sexism in family roles. My mother mostly did not work unless my father's gambling and drinking got him so out of control that we didn't have any money.
Growing up queer in a small logging town of Klamath Falls in Oregon didn't help either, but she held her own.
When I was 5, I knew that I didn't want to be a mother or a housewife. I knew at 5 years old. I was always what they called a tomboy. I played baseball. I beat the boys up. That was just me.
So when she graduated high school and had a chance to leave small-town life to go to Seattle, she took it. Bow soon got a job at the post office, working in the mailroom and as a clerk. But one day, you could say an opportunity presented itself to Bow. An opportunity of the illegal kind.
I found a letter one time from a apartment manager to a landlord that was full of cash. People paid their rent in cash. And they got receipts for their rent, and then the manager guy sent it to the landlord. Well, if it never got to the landlord, it got lost in the mail. So it got lost in my mail. So, and they got hip to me. I mean, I wasn't real stupid with it, but I was a bar dyke then. I had discovered the bars, and I had discovered acid, and I had discovered an interesting crew of little people to hang out with.
Bo was caught and given a sentence of 1 year and a day. Because of that one extra day, she did her time at the penitentiary instead of a work program. There, she met Pearl in a group of women exchanging radical books.
Well, she started telling me about some reading that they were doing. Like, there was a group of black women in this prison who were reading, right? And she brought me a couple books. I don't remember what the other books were. I just remember that she brought me Blood in My Eye. And my assignment was to read this book and never let it be seen by anyone, and then her and I would discuss it. And I was reading that book when George Jackson was killed in San Quentin.
That book, Blood in My Eye, written by incarcerated Black Panther Party member George Jackson, presented his analysis of systematic prison abuse, class war, and communism. After her release, Bo began to work with the Women Out Now Prison Project, a group providing community services for women just getting out of prison. She also began working at a print shop publishing an underground prison newspaper.
And we were reading all this stuff. I mean, there was stuff happening all over the country. There was a group of prisoners in, I think, Oklahoma. The acronym for their name was Cat Shit. I can't remember now what all that meant. But they actually burned down part of their prison in protest to conditions in their prisons.
Intense radicalism charged the current of 1970s activism. Soon, the fledgling two-member George Jackson Brigade invited Bo to join and participate in their anti-capitalist activities. Why did she decide to go underground, to participate in violent political armed struggle?
I guess I was of the mind that you have to be about what you say you're about. You know, anybody can talk shit. Anybody. Talk is cheap. What do you do? What's your action? Who are you really? Based on a lot of words, anybody can talk. What can you do? What can you do?
And so, Bo started to take part in the underground operations of the brigade. She became the gentleman bank robber, dressing in drag and robbing banks to fund their political actions.
So we had John Sherman with us, who we had just busted out of jail, who's on the top 10 most wanted list. So we can't really, and he just got shot in the face, so he's a little, he don't really want to go in the bank, right? So somebody had to go in the bank because we didn't have any money. So when I went into the bank, I just like, I always had a little bit of mustache, so we just did eyebrow pencil on that. And I always wore hat. I always identified me as a man. They used to think I was John Sherman, but he's like 6 foot tall or something. I don't know how they did that. But they did, because they could never admit that it was a woman. It was beyond their capacity of thought.
Bo Brown took part in over a dozen bank robberies in Oregon and Washington from 1975 to 1977. Finally, she got caught by the FBI in 1977 outside of a Seattle laundromat. She was convicted of violating the Federal Firearms Act and committing 5 bank robberies. She spent 8 years in jail. Still holding strong to her beliefs about armed struggle, Bo does not regret her time in the brigade.
I think that no one in our community went to jail. No above ground people went to jail. I think that the communication that happened with the above ground and the underground, I think it just shows that a community is a bigger thing and can function on multi levels. I mean, if I had to do it all again back in the time, back in the circumstances were the same, I would do it again because I could. Of course, you can always do everything better. It's not going to change until we do it better. And it's not going to change in the next round. There are many rounds left.
Today, Rita Bo Brown works as a tow truck driver in Oakland, California. But she is still very much involved in political activism, though planning bank robberies has been replaced by planning above-ground fundraisers. She formed the group Out of Control, Lesbian Committee to Support Women Political Prisoners, and travels around the country speaking to activist groups about her experiences. For One World Report, I'm Amber Cortez.
You can hear past episodes of the One World Report at their website,
kbcs.fm, or you can also stream it from that site live on Thursday nights at 5 p.m. Next up, we'll hear from Mark Cook, a George Jackson Brigade member and Walla Walla Black Panther. The speech was recorded November 18th, 2008, at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington.
I'm Mark Cook. Before and after, the before was I was just, you know, a common person. I didn't have any political activism at all within me. I just couldn't see anything. And I'd been in prison a couple times, but the second time I went, that's when I became politicized. That was about 1967. That's when I became aware of the founding of the Black Panther Party. And that was founded due to conditions that existed then, horrendous conditions that don't exist today. They still exist in a different form, but we took direct action, kind of an intense action by setting up a model. You've seen around here, I passed around the Panther Party 10-point program. That was the model that was set up that we were to go by in order to try and correct the conditions in our community. Racism was so strong that the black community, people felt safe in the black community. And we decided to make the community ours and make it progressive. And that was what the Panther Party was trying to do. Other communities, the Barrio, Brown Berets, followed the model of the Black Panther Party and did the same there. And these models were picked up by others to try and help their communities. It kind of upset the government that we were taking it in our own hands to try and help our communities. And so they started bringing in programs about that time to undermine the credibility of those groups that were going on. This is, in a sense, before. This is 1967. Like I say, I was in prison at the time. So I started, myself and my captain, Clement Blanchey, started a Black Panther Party in the Walla Walla State Penitentiary. That was my first real insight into political activism inside a prison, and it went much beyond that. We figured out a way to actually take over a certain part of the prison and create a positive program where prisoners worked. It's the only time prisoners worked, had their own business, and paid themselves, the highest paid prisoners in the United States at that time because of the program we set up. And we worked out of the prison industries and became the only shop within the industries that made money. All the others were losing at that time. But this wasn't due just to myself. It was due to other people who became influenced by the activism that was going on outside of prison. And that grew. It grew across all cultures. And after doing time, I came to Seattle. That was about 1972, and set up a program, an above program, ground program called the Convention 72. This was to encourage and enhance and get support for prisoner labor and prisoners' right to vote, etc. Again, it was a long time ago, and things have changed since then. Prisoners have been getting the right to vote slowly. Not prisoners, but ex-prisoners, where they never had it before. But what I'm trying to say is that the little things we did then really count for what's happening today. And we were looked as terrorists, whether it's the Panther Party or the Brigade or the SDS, the Weather Underground, AIM. Today we looked at, looking back at them now, we call them terrorists. But we were the ones that gave the impetus to keep things going, which brought about what is happening today, 40 years later. And yeah, kind of keep this in mind, that you can't separate them. You can't look, put this in a pocket and say, well, that's just part of history that had nothing to do with reality, what's happening today. That's not the way it goes. You have to struggle, constantly struggle, and bring things up. And that's what we're doing today. And it's the reason I'm here, is trying to encourage you to find models that you can involve yourselves in order to help correct some of the things that are going wrong in our communities and our nation today. But I want to talk about the creation of my activism. Like I said, after I got out, I met some people in the George Jackson Brigade. I was influenced by what they were doing, and the first people in the brigade that I knew were, in a sense, expelled, and a new unit of the brigade was created, and I was able to help develop that second brigade, or that the new unit of the brigade. And I want Ed to go ahead and take it from here. Where he, how he came in, his history is before and afters. Oh, well, before he gets into it, I'll tell you about my after. I'm an investigator. I work with investigations in the Defender Association downtown. That's in downtown Seattle. That is an agency that helps people who cannot afford prisoners and, I mean, not prisoners, attorneys. And we supply attorneys, investigators, and paralegals to help those people.
That was Mark Cook. To hear the rest of the speech, go to publish.indymedia.org. We'll now hear from Ed Mead, another former member of the George Jackson Brigade. He begins the interview by answering the question, how did you become politicized?
How did I become politicized? Well, first of all, I was a social prisoner. And what that means is I was in prison for a social rather than a political offense. And this is in the late 60s, and the Vietnam War was waging then. And if someone had asked me my opinion on the Vietnam War, I probably would have said something to the effect that, oh, we ought to bomb Vietnam back into the Stone Age, you know. Not because I believe that, but because I heard some older man saying something to that effect, and I would, in the absence of an opinion of my own, I would have just parroted something like that. I didn't know. I wasn't political. So I was serving time in McNeil Island, and I was serving time for a crime I didn't commit. And so I got involved in the law library and started doing legal work. At one point, there was a strike. The Men's Advisory Council, which was kind of our elected prisoner government, had called for a strike over a number of issues around conditions. And I participated. And what I noticed is that the people that held that backwards view of the Vietnam War were the same ones who were against parole, who supported the death penalty, who advocated longer and longer sentences for prisoners, whereas the people who opposed the war were the ones who busted Timothy Leary out of prison in California. They were the ones that wanted shorter sentences. They were against the death penalty on a whole number of fronts like that. So it didn't take me long to develop some sort of an opinion, you know, like where my interests lie in terms of this conflict, this whole Vietnam War, whatever it is. And so I started reading. First, I was reading anarchist literature, and over a period of time, I came to identify, not as a criminal, but I came to identify as a radical, as an understanding that there was an us and a them, and that I was part of us. I wasn't sure what that meant, but I knew that I was no longer a criminal, that I was now something different and something I could feel good about and something I could feel proud of. And so I studied politics for a lot of years after that, and I became active in the prisoners' movement there, and prisoners' rights movement, and prisoners' rights litigation, and that was how that went. So to make a long story short, I continued my studies. I read a lot of Marxism and came to identify as a communist, and that's how I still identify today.
And then how did you move from there to joining the George Jackson Brigade?
I was a jailhouse lawyer, and I was a pretty good one at McNeil Island, and that was back when it was a federal penitentiary. And some of these radicals were coming into the prison. And one of them was a guy named Chuck Armsberry from Portland, who was part of the White Panthers. He came in on a illegal firearms charge, and he wrote this lawsuit called the Genocide Complaint. And what it said is that 70% of the prisoners at McNeil Island came from California, and their families were poor. It was hard for them to travel the distance. He filed this complaint. It had absolutely no legal merit whatsoever. It was frivolous, in my opinion. So I told him, I'll show you how to file a prisoner's rights suit. So I filed a class action lawsuit, class action habeas corpus, in the local federal court on the inadequate law books in the law library, that they weren't sufficient for us to do our legal research. And my case wound its way through the federal courts up to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and I won. I won nothing. It was an empty victory, maybe a few law books in the prison law library. But in objective terms, it wasn't anything. Whereas this frivolous lawsuit that he had filed, a group of about 50 people marched to the federal courthouse and filed this suit. And it was used as an organizing tool and an education tool around prisons. And out of that lawsuit came the Silicone Prisoner Support House, where as many as 20 visitors, family members, children and wives or whatever, could stay and be fed and transportation to and from the ferry dock going over to the island. We'd pick them up at the airport or the train station or bus station and drive them to the house. And when they were done visiting their loved ones, we'd take them back, fed them and had laundry facilities. And it was a nice place. And so that's what came out of that lawsuit. And so my Chuck Armsbury was really a part of my political maturation process. So when I got out, I went to the Steelcomb Prisoner Support House and stayed there for about 3 months, working with the volunteers there and doing whatever I could do. And then I went to Seattle, where another former prisoner from McNeil Island, John Sherman, and I formed the Washington State Prisoners Labor Union and started. Well, we did a lot of things. I mean, there's no use going into all the little things that we did. That the American Correctional Association held their annual conference in Seattle during that period. And the theme of the conference was the psychological effects of long-term incarceration. This was being held at the Seattle Center. And as it happens, we had a friend that worked there. And he gave us a lot of the people who were, you know, don't come to these conferences, but ID badges are made up for them. So we had all of these ID badges, and my ID badge was Captain such and such from Arkansas. And so a whole big group of us, I guess we were about 25 or 30 of us, went into this conference, and we just sat there. They had these military guys who had done time in Vietnamese prisons as prisoners of war. That's who they were going to have talk about the long-term psychological effects of long-term incarceration. And so at the appropriate moment, we jumped up and said, hey, how come you're not talking about American prisoners who are serving all this time? And then somebody else would jump up and say something similar, and somebody else, and somebody else. And finally, some of us just went up there on the stage and started talking. And about a third of the people in the auditorium walked out. And during the course of our diatribe, another third got up and walked out. And the last third stayed for the whole humiliating punishment that we inflicted on them. We did a lot of things like that. And the years passed. Prisoners at Walla Walla had, in 1971, they'd taken over. They had went on strike for essentially for long hair and beards. And the director of corrections then, Dr. Conte, had just returned from a trip to the Netherlands, where he was touring prisons there. And he came back with this notion of prisoners governing themselves, you know, kind of a 50-50 where the administration has half the power and the prisoners have half the power. So prisoners went on strike for long hair and beards, and they won self-government. Well, you know, in order to exercise power responsibly, you have to struggle for it, and you learn how to do that in the process of doing so. The prisoners did pretty darn good, considering the circumstances. I mean, if a prisoner was drunk on Pruno, for example, you know, kind of a home brew, they would take him to the hole and let him sleep it off overnight and let him out in the morning. And they had a legislature, they had an elected president. They did a pretty good job. Where they failed was in. They didn't want to be cops. They didn't want to be police. So if there was things that were not good for the prison population as a whole, such as drug use or raping prisoners, they wouldn't intervene in that kind of thing. So they had their weaknesses as well. But the guards hated this and did everything they could to undermine and cause it to erode. So some years passed, and in 1974, prisoners took over sections of the prison and took some guards hostage. There was a huge build-up to this, you know, with meetings with the administration, and finally it came to this. Look, either you allow us our right to govern ourselves, or and what this is essentially a struggle for democracy, or we'll burn this damn place down. The administration wouldn't give, and so that's what they did. They took over sections of the prison. The rebellion was forcibly suppressed, and the ringleaders were placed in the hole. And while in the hole, they were being brutalized by guards. I mean, they'd taken guards hostage, and there were some injuries. And so these prisoners were being brutalized, and they sent word out to the streets, you know, we need some support, we need some help. So letters like that would come to, would eventually reach us. And I went around and talked to different groups in Seattle, and there just wasn't any energy to get some kind of mass movement or mass organization or mobilization or something together to support these prisoners who had been struggling for democracy and were being punished as a result of it. And about that same time, there was a huge struggle in the Seattle community led by the United Construction Workers, which was an organization of black construction workers. And what was happening is there was a lot of money, a lot of federal money for contracts and building things within the Central District, which is Seattle's black area. But the people who were hired to do the construction work were all white. This was a major struggle in Seattle. So during the height of this struggle, Bruce Seidel and another guy were talking, and I happened to be there, and they said, why don't we firebomb the offices of this racist contractor and see what happens, see what the public reaction is within the progressive community. So they went out and did that and destroyed that office. And the next day, we kind of went around, talked to people, and never let on that we knew who did it. And the response was positive. So in the absence of being able to develop any kind of an above-ground movement or any support for these struggling prisoners, it was decided that some of us would drop out of the progressive community and go underground and bomb the headquarters of the Department of Corrections in the state capital in Olympia and issue a communique saying that, you know, exposing what they're doing to prisoners what role in the state's apparatus of repression that the prisons play and the courts and the police and all that. So that's what we did. We went underground. We learned how to build bombs. And the prison takeover took place in December of 1974. And in May of 1975, we busted into the headquarters of the Department of Corrections in Olympia and planted a six-inch diameter pipe bomb under the director's desk and issued a communique. We did not know what we wanted to call ourselves, but we recalled a quote from a prison activist in California named George Jackson, who was assassinated by prison guards. And he wrote some books. One of them was Soledad Brother, and another one was Blood in My Eye. And in Blood in My Eye, he said, hurl me into the next existence. I don't care what you do. I'll come back. I'll dog you from the grave. And we thought it was probably about time that somebody made good on George's promise. And so we called ourselves the George Jackson Brigade. And we went on to do a lot of other actions. The brigade went on for years. I was caught during a brigade bank robbery in early 1976.
You are listening to Circle A Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. Tonight, we are talking about the importance of supporting political prisoners with members of the George Jackson Brigade and with Lydia Barthlow, organizer of the Raise the Walls Conference, which was created to nurture a greater understanding of the connections between policing, prisons, and political prisoners. We now go back to our interview with Ed Mead, former member of the George Jackson Brigade, a mixed-theory, multiracial, multigendered, anti-imperialist revolutionary group active in the 1970s.
This generation or the last, there's people doing time in prison who have served 30 and 40 years who need to be supported. If the last generation of political prisoners are not supported, there won't be a next one. It's as simple as that. These people went to prison. They put their very lives on the line. In the struggle for justice, it's incumbent on those of us out here to do what we can. And one of the ways that they can do that is by becoming a part of the Portland Jericho movement. What they're trying to do, what Jericho is trying to do, is to build an amnesty campaign for these for the men, these men who have been down for so long, and to make sure that they have adequate medical care, and to provide what legal defense they can. The right-wing political prisoners, the wackos who kill clinic doctors at abortion clinics, they are called prisoners of Christ. They get regular visits, care packages. School children write them letters. They're taken care of. And our prisoners on the left need to be taken care of, too. But in terms of people doing prison work, there's three priorities, and it's international, national, and local. On the international level, there are people held in places like Guantanamo and other secret detention facilities where they've been stripped of their right to habeas corpus. These international prisoners need to be defended, and the left has done, to put it charitably, a woeful job of falling in behind these Muslim prisoners from Afghanistan and places like that, who are held under deplorable conditions and tortured in places like Guantanamo. Secondly, there's the national level. One of the priorities on a national level would be defending the life of Mumia Abu-Jamal. There should always be energy going into not only Mumia's case, but the case of other political prisoners who are on death row or who have served lots and lots of time and deserve to be out having served 30 or 40 years. And lastly, there's the local, working to make social prisoners rights-conscious and rights-conscious prisoners class-conscious. You do this by building a prison struggle from whatever state you're in. Here are people who are held in a state of dependency and irresponsibility. They're disenfranchised. They're literal slaves of the state. And that's a status legitimized by the 13th Amendment of the Constitution. The 13th Amendment abolished slavery for everyone except those convicted of a crime. Can you imagine? Most of these prisons are located in remote areas. For example, the Washington State Penitentiary is located in Walla Walla. If these prisoners could vote, the local politicians would be courting them. Things could change. It's also, moving in this direction is an attack on the bourgeois constitution. There will be people, but who in their right mind is going to stand up and oppose the elimination of slavery? Who in their right mind is going to stand up and oppose universal voting rights for all? Justice and right are on the side of progress, and these are struggles that can be built with the involvement of prisoners and with the involvement of their family members, can be won. I know some of these things seem, you know, like voting rights and giving prisoners the right to exercise some responsibility seem strange right now, but when I was a kid, there were laws against interracial marriages. When I was young, who would have thought that one of the topics of the day would be gay marriage? And so things change, and that's what we have to understand, is that things change, and they can change rapidly.
You're coming to Portland as part of the Raise the Walls conference. What are you hoping to share with the audience? What are you hoping that people are going to come there to learn from you and from the rest of the people that will be there from the brigade and other experiences?
Well, I'll tell you what. The anti-war movement started out with the largest demonstrations in human history. In cities across the globe, millions turned out to try and stop the invasion of Iraq. Of course, the ruling class has little regard for, you know, what we think or what we want, and the war took place. Every year since then, there's been demonstrations. I participated in them when I lived in San Francisco. We would meet at Dolores Park, and we would march to the Civic Center, where we would listen to the same yahoos say the same thing, march after march after march. The only thing that changed is every year our numbers would decrease. There were about 30 of us about a year ago, and they marched us from point A to point B. The movement has spiraled and spiraled and spiraled down and down and down, and they don't try anything else. There's no militancy. And it would seem to me that if you keep doing the same thing and you're not getting any results, that maybe you ought to try something else. But our leaders on the left don't do that. It's time to implement something that used to be active back in the day. Criticism, self-criticism. Alternatives need to be found to existing modes of struggle, because the conditions could not be riper for developing mass struggle. I don't have any answers for people, but I do have some questions.
That was Ed Mead, former member of the George Jackson Brigade, here on Circle A Radio. He will be coming to Portland, along with Rita Bo Brown and Mark Cook, to speak at Raise the Walls, a one-day mini-conference that seeks to nurture a greater understanding of the connections between policing, prisons, and political prisoners. This conference will be Sunday, October 3rd, on the Portland State University campus in downtown Portland from 3 to 6 p.m.
All the proceeds from this conference will be donated to the following causes. For Struggle magazine compiles writing by prisoners of war as well as political prisoners. They also publish works by the friends and families of prisoners. For Struggle magazine advocates for justice, equality, freedom, and socialism, as well as protection of earth, human rights, and peace. To learn more about For Struggle magazine, visit their website, the number 4strugglemag.org. The Anarchist Black Cross Federation's War Chest Program sends donated money to political prisoners and prisoners of war who have been receiving insufficient or no financial help while in prison. Money donated to this program is then given to prisoners in the form of a monthly check. The War Chest Program also offers emergency funding for prisoners in need of one-time emergency financial help. For more information on this program, visit www.abcf.net. Proceeds from this conference will also be donated to the Freedom Archives, an organization dedicated to preserving the audio of solidarity movements from the 1960s to the 1990s, both in the United States and internationally. The Freedom Archives hold over 8,000 hours of audio and videotape pertaining to gay and lesbian, student, anti-war, women's, civil rights, and prisoners' movements. Next is an excerpt from 30 Years After the Murder of George Jackson, a radio segment available on the Freedom Archives that reflects on the life and death of George Jackson, political prisoner and Black Panther, for whom the George Jackson Brigade was named.
Saturday, August 21st, 1971.
Today at about 3 p.m., there was an attempted break from our adjustment center, which is our maximum security facility. George Jackson was killed as he broke and ran outside the adjustment center.
Well, I could die tomorrow, but there'll be 200 or 300 people to take my place.
This is one black man they're not going to murder and sweep under the rug, unless they murder me too.
Today we present The Struggle Inside, the 30-year anniversary of the murder of George Jackson, a program about the origins of the modern anti-prison movement. My name is Jonathan Jackson, Jr. In 1960, at the age of 18, George Jackson was accused of stealing $70 from a gas station near Los Angeles. Though there was evidence of his innocence, his court-appointed lawyer maintained that because Jackson had a record, two instances of petty crime, he should plead guilty in exchange for a light sentence in the county jail. He did, and instead received an indeterminate sentence of 1 year to life. Jackson spent the next 10 years in prison, 7.5 of them in solitary confinement. Instead of succumbing to the dehumanization of prison existence, he transformed himself into the leading theoretician of the prison movement and a brilliant writer. On January 16th, 1969, a few days after a prison guard shot and killed three black Soledad inmates, Another guard was found beaten to death.
Soledad was a real intense place.
David Johnson, prison activist and former prisoner.
There had been a lot of killings in the hole. Most of the killings had taken place. They were either racial killings, and then there was a couple of instances where guards had, during cell extractions, had tear gassed and killed inmates. Detention there was real high. The assassinations on the yards of W.L. Nolan, Alvin Miller, and Cleveland Edwards triggered this whole upheaval in the California penal system.
The three, who became known as the Soledad brothers, were brought in chains and shackles to two secret hearings in Salinas County, and so commenced one of the most extensive legal defenses in U.S. history. The Soledad brothers were charged with murder, not because there was any substantial evidence of their guilt, but because they had been identified as black militants by the prison authorities. If convicted, they would face a mandatory death sentence.
The Soledad brothers all have his basis and his connection with the Black Panther Party.
David Hilliard, Black Panther Party leader.
George, who says himself that it was the Black Panther Party more than anything that gave expression to political prisoners as a voice.
Notice had to be served on the Department of Corrections that you just cannot wantonly kill black people without some type of response. Adhere to Malcolm X's philosophy, there's nothing wrong with self-defense. When those brothers got killed on the yard, the courts ruled that it was justifiable homicide. What alternative do you have as a group?
The Soledad brothers' case emerged as a focal point for a growing movement demanding changes within California prisons. It was a time when the American status quo was shaken by black rebellion in more than 100 cities, as well as the mass movement against the Vietnam War.
These ideas were developed against the backdrop of progressive revolutions transforming the globe.
Angela Davis, prison abolitionist and University of California professor.
The struggles of the Vietnamese people, for example. The fact that increasing numbers of countries in Africa were achieving their independence. And today people tend to think about the movements of the 60s as movements that were very separate, nationalists, racially defined, because they're looking at them through the lens of what is generally considered to be identity politics today. But as a matter of fact, the Black Power movement per se was not an exclusive movement. There were people of all racial, ethnic backgrounds involved in that movement. There was a connection with global movements. And there was a connection with the Young Lords, the Brown Berets, the American Indian movement. We were part of a global revolution. There was no question about the importance of making those connections and building those bridges.
The prison was our battleground, our battlefield.
David Johnson.
It wasn't in isolation with what was taking place outside. Because as people start to raise their voices about civil rights violations and human rights violations, then brothers inside, through civil litigation, through protests, strikes, and stuff like that, fought to gain their civil rights and human rights.
On August 7th, 1970, just a short time after George Jackson was transferred to San Quentin Prison, the Soledad brothers' case was catapulted to the forefront of national news when George's brother, Jonathan, a 17-year-old high school student in Pasadena, led a raid on the Marin County Courthouse with a satchel full of handguns, an assault rifle, and a shotgun hidden under his coat. Educated as a political revolutionary by his brother, Jonathan invaded the court during a hearing for three San Quentin inmates, not including his brother, and handed them weapons. As Jonathan left the courthouse, leading the three prisoners and five hostages, including the judge, he demanded that the Soledad brothers be released. Prison guards and other authorities opened fire on the escape van, killing Jonathan Jackson, William Christmas, James McLean, and the judge. Only one black prisoner, Rochelle McGee, survived what has become known as the Marin County Rebellion. Rochelle McGee.
This is one of the reasons I fight so hard and fight back, and will continue to do so, with the belief that I've always had, as long as you fight, nobody know how the fight gonna come out. It's a possibility I might win, but I know if I stop, I cannot win. I also believe that one man can make a difference if he's sincere.
Of Jonathan, George wrote, "He was free for a while. I guess that's more than most of us can expect." George Jackson, recorded in San Quentin before his murder.
I don't think that it's fair to Jonathan Jackson. I don't think it's fair to William Christmas or to James McLean or Brother McGee. I don't think it's fair at all to try to bury those brothers' examples.
And, you know, Jonathan sacrificed his life for the cause of freeing his brother and all of those who were unjustly imprisoned.
There wasn't one thing that could stop those brothers from attaining what they started out to do. I think it was well thought out. The mistake was in underestimating the viciousness of the prison guards.
David Hilliard.
Jonathan Jackson made an attempt to free George and other political prisoners. Certainly a revolutionary action. Jonathan and the judge and William Christmas and James McLean were all killed in that event. And Rochelle McGee, who still lingers in prison, was also a part of that attempt to free those brothers from prison.
Rochelle McGee, prison activist and jailhouse lawyer, still in prison for his political resistance.
Slavery is something that is being practiced by the system under the color of law. Slavery 400 years ago, slavery today. It's the same, but with a new name. They're making millions and millions of dollars off of enslaving blacks, poor whites, and others daily. Peoples who don't even know that they are being railroaded.
George Jackson.
The only way the oppressor can maintain his position is by fostering, nurturing, building contempt for the oppressed. The brutality really leads to more resistance, and that's what we're working for, revolution. The institutions that buttress the establishment have to be assaulted.
Hugo Pinnell, prison activist and leader, still in prison for his political activities and resistance.
Well, I'm a revolutionary in the sense that I believe that what the word means, to change something, you know, in a big way. There's many changes that got to happen in order for the people on the bottom, the people like black people, Latinos, and, you know, in the United States and throughout the world. I feel that there are many things that has to happen before we can get justice.
For more information on the Freedom Archives, or to listen to the complete audio for 30 Years After the Murder of George Jackson, visit www.freedomarchives.org.
Again, the Raise the Walls one-day mini-conference will be on Sunday, October 3rd, on the Portland State University campus from 3 to 6 p.m. Also, that Sunday will be the Butch Voices Regional Conference. It also takes place at Portland State University at 1825 Southwest Broadway in the Smith Memorial Student Union. For more information on that conference, go to butchvoices.com.
We'd like to thank our guests, Lydia Barthlow and Ed Mead, and also thanks to the One World Report for the Rita Bo Brown interview, and Indie Media for the speech by Mark Cook.
You have been listening to Circle A Radio. Circle A Radio airs the first and third Wednesday here on your community radio station, KBOO, in Portland, Oregon. You can contact us through the website, kboo.fm/circlearadio. You can also hear most of our past shows there. You can also contact us at circlearadio@gmail.com.
Our next show airs October 6th during KBOO's Fall Membership Drive. We'll be looking forward to your support. Thanks for listening.